Would you like to turn to Psalm 3, please? You might remember that I started a... we're on 3 now, so we'll call it a series on Psalms. Phil helpfully jumped in and did number 2 after I did number 1, you may remember. And unless he jumps in and does a few more, or I skip a few, I might be in this for the rest of my life, I think, on Thursday nights, because I'm not sure I knew what I was getting into. But we haven't skipped any. We're going straight into number 3 after we did 1 and 2 previously. So Psalm 3. Let's read Psalm 3 together, and then I'll give a brief reminder of what we've already looked at, and then we'll come to Psalm 3 tonight. Lord, how they have increased who trouble me. Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory and the one who lifts up my head. I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people. You'll notice at the top it's entitled, if we could call it, I'll use that word, A Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. That's really important. Sometimes at the top of our psalms we get other introductions that are normally in italics. In my Bible this one says, the Lord helps his troubled people. As far as I understand, they've been inserted by others in more recent times. But actually, the piece that says a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son, in previous versions would have actually been verse 1, and the psalm would have been a verse longer. So that's really important. And it's especially important in this psalm because you need to understand a bit of the context for where David is to understand the place from where his psalm comes. So we'll come on to that in a minute. Not to keep you hanging. Psalms. Last time we looked at Psalms and we had a brief introduction to Psalms. We saw that it has 150 chapters, so it's actually the biggest book in the Bible. We looked at the fact that we don't know the author of nearly 50 of the Psalms. It's a third. We know that King David wrote about half. And the remainder were written by the likes of Asaph and the sons of Korah. We looked at, so I remind you, the Psalms were written at various times and in various circumstances between 1410 BC and 450 BC, so over about 1,000 years. The most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament is the Book of Psalms, which is why I thought it would be good to start looking at this. And then we have done Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 already. Psalm 1, if I put it into one line, could be explained as this. Psalm 1, the way of the righteous and the way of the ungodly. Subtitle, settle your commitment. And then Phil helpfully did Psalm 2 a few weeks later, back in September now. And the summary of that could be, get yourself a clear view of the kingdom. Okay. Very, very quick reminder of what we've done. So tonight we come to Psalm 3, and I must start, I think, by giving credit to Messrs. Dale Ralph Davis and Philip Eason, whose help I've gone to for Psalm 3 tonight. So let's look at the Psalm. Psalm 3, by way of introduction. Psalm 3 then is written by David. I've just mentioned that it's a Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. This is King David, of course. This psalm is written at the time of events that are actually recorded in 2 Samuel chapters 15 to 18. I contemplated reading all of that, but I thought we definitely need time for prayer, so I'm not going to read all of those chapters, but we do touch on it a little bit later. But I'm sure most of you remember at least the outline of Absalom going against his father, David, seeking the kingship from him and being a bit naughty, going behind his father's back. We know that David was not a perfect man, don't we? And this is quite likely, almost undoubtedly, the Lord's judgment on David after the whole Bathsheba failing. When we come to why Psalm 3 is Psalm 3. I have to quote this thing from Dale Ralph Davis because I loved it. Isn't the placing of Psalm 3 interesting? You first go through the double doors of the Psalter with Psalm 1 telling you to settle your commitment and Psalm 2 to get a clear view of the kingdom. Then what? You walk into trouble. I think what Mr. Davis is getting at is that this is the Christian's likely experience, that after the highs of Psalm 1 and 2 come the troubles and difficulties of Psalm 3. If this is likely to be our experience as God's children, then we should look at what the way the Lord has provided for response. How should we respond? How does David respond? He prays. Prayer is the Lord's provided way of responding. So we're going to look at Psalm 3 under three headings. I wish they all started with the same letter or rhymed or did something clever. They don't, so just try and remember them. The three headings that we're going to look under Psalm 3 are lament, confidence, and expectation. Lament, confidence, and expectation. So lament, that's verses 1 and 2, if you want to just keep sort of glancing down as we go through. Verses 1 and 2, lament. David is clearly in distress, isn't he, as he writes this. It certainly would appear to be one of the low or lowest points in his kingship. We know from 2 Samuel 15, the beginning of those four chapters that I mentioned, that Absalom had managed to steal the hearts of many Israelites. He managed to meet people coming into the city and convince them that he could take care of all of their problems. Come to me, I'll sort you out. And then as you go on in chapter 15, you read about how he gathered lots of people together and how he then effectively started a revolt against his own dad, the king. He managed to steal many people away, many of the Israelite people, from following David. Did you notice the multiple use of the word many in verses 1 and 2? Many are they who rise up against me. Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God. David was troubled. David obviously really felt this. It was really affecting him at the time he was writing this psalm. This is actually an immediate example of Psalm 2 verse 2, which Phil did do back in September, where the so-called kings of this earth are plotting against the Lord. Because make no mistake, that's ultimately what Absalom is doing here. Against David equals against God. Against God's anointed. David specifically refers to people saying that God was no longer on his side, doesn't he, at the end of verse 2 there? No, God was no longer helping him. I don't think that was meant by the people as a slight on God, actually, as far as I understand, but more a slight on David and his deserving of God's favour. There are actually tones of the Gospel of Matthew chapter 27 verse 43 here, where those crucifying Jesus said what? Let God deliver him if he'll have him. Can I pause briefly for a point of application for us all here? We too might hear a voice in our head sometimes saying, well, you don't deserve God's favour. And it's true. I hate to break it to all of us. It's true. We don't deserve God's favour at all. I don't deserve the least of God's mercies. But the thing that we should do and we must do then is actually come before God and confess that very fact and proceed to rely wholly and only and claim only the righteousness of Jesus for us, for ourselves. So what is David's response then? Verses 1 and 2, he's lamenting, he's worried, he's fearful, he's in times of trouble. What's his response? Well, he's already doing it, isn't he? He's talking to God. Prayer. That's the answer. Prayer. That brings us on to the point 2 then. So we've done lament. Point 2 is confidence. Slightly longer point, this one. Confidence. Verses 3 to 6. 3 to 6. Confidence. Yes, David had sinned. His sinful nature had not been removed just because he was God's chosen king. that he was still a man after God's own heart. It's important to remember that. David had not forgotten, and he knew the place from where his help came. In verse 3, what's the word that he uses? "But you, O Lord, are a shield for me." Trouble, 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 worry, fear, fear, Lord, you are my shield. Verse 3. He refers to the Lord as a shield. He knew a truly personal relationship with his God, didn't he? David says more in verse 3. He tells God that he was his glory. "My glory and the one who lifts up my head." Now, this is actually astounding. If you go home and read 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 30 in particular, it's astounding if you read that, because David in those verses in chapter 15 of 2 Samuel is showing signs of huge, real grief and sorrow over what's going on with his son Absalom. Even to the point where we read and understand from that passage that he covered his head with dust, he was walking around barefoot, and these were signs that, and he was weeping as well. These are all signs that he was sorrowful about what was going on, grieving. And yet in the midst of that reaction, imagine David now like that, barefoot, weeping, dust on his head. In the midst of all of that, he can still write this psalm, telling God that God is his glory. He must have had a magnificent view of his God to be able to do that, I'm going to suggest. He's basically acknowledging that whilst he appeared to be losing his kingly glory and his station in the world, if you like, that he actually had all the glory that he needed in Yahweh. So, David acknowledges then that he has a protecting God, shield. He has a sufficient God, his glory. Third point under confidence here, he has a restoring God. I love this. Look at the second half of verse 3. He says, "You are my glory and the one who lifts up my head." Now we can understand this, can't we? This language about, he says, "God, you are the one that lifts up my head." Have you ever felt down, discouraged, and then you get that, I'm going to put it into 21st century, you get that text message that encourages you on with something or lifts you up? That little whisper in the ear sometime that says, "Well done." It does lift us, doesn't it? It inspires us. David is saying, "God, you lift up my head. You are all the glory that I need." So he's a restoring God. Fourthly then, under this point of confidence, David shows us that he and we, it's important that we put ourselves into this psalm, I think, we have an accessible God. David knows that he is calling out to someone who is 100% listening and 100% able to do something. There's zero sense here for me that David thought that his prayer, that his speaking with God here, was futile. And in verse 4, he even acknowledges that God heard him, even though he was far from the physical holy hill of Zion, which is what the Israelites would have expected to be near to receive that blessing. Can I pause one more time for a point of application for all of us, myself most definitely included? Was David's gaze at this point on his circumstances? Was he wallowing in his dusty head and bare feet? Was his gaze on himself, on what he himself could do or should do? Was he planning what he could do? Not a bit of it. His gaze was on God, his surety. Can we, can I, learn a lesson from this? Well, I know I can, because I am constantly too quick to gaze around me and rely on myself. Sarah's very good at picking me up on this. And I'm not quick enough to look up, to look to God, and to rely on God the way that David did. And we're going to see a little bit more now in the next few verses about how that looked for David, to be relying so entirely on God. His gaze was not on his circumstances or on himself. It was on his God, his surety. So I want to suggest then that David here models real God-centeredness and real Godward focus. Still under this heading of confidence, we're still on point two, confidence, verses 5 and 6. David slept. I lay down and slept. This is a massive deal. I don't know if, kind of when I read that, maybe I read it too quickly, and I don't know if that sort of sinks into you. This is a massive deal. He knew that it was incredibly likely that thousands of men were being readied to come after him right now. David has run away because he knows what Absalom is plotting, okay? He knows there's thousands of men that are undoubtedly being ready to come after him. He knew that they would most likely come under the cover of darkness, much like in modern era now, where that would be seen as an advantageous way to attack. Yet, in the midst of all of that possibility, he slept. He managed to sleep. Well, I don't know about you, but that convicts me of some sleepless nights that I've had, if David could sleep in amongst all that. But no, seriously, of course, we do all struggle with that from time to time, don't we? And that's a natural human reaction, I think, to things. But David's response certainly reveals that his faith and his trust was in God alone. It did lead me to look at Psalm 127. Maybe I'll skip forward to this one next time. I'll get through them quickly. Psalm 127 verse 2 says this: "It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep." Final point of application under this heading of confidence. David didn't just feel like he could only sleep for one night. He trusts God's long-term deliverance here. And we too can and should seek to let this confidence in God control our view of future days, even with all its uncertainty. You could summarise it as confidence in the midst of uncertainty, not outside of uncertainty. That's what David demonstrates for us here. So, we've had lament. We've had confidence, and then thirdly, to finish off Psalm 3, expectation. Expectation, verses 7 and 8. I was confused when I read verse 7, I've got to be honest and admit, when David asks the Lord to arise, because I thought, but David, you're the one who's just been asleep. I then discovered that this is a throwback to what Moses used to say as the Israelites moved camp with the Ark of the Covenant before them. In Numbers 10, verses 35 to 36, Moses would say this: "Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Think of David saying this and writing this: "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God." David's petitioning God expectantly, isn't he? Having declared his confidence in God, he then says, "Save me, O my God." He's expectantly petitioning his great God. I'm not going to spend ages talking about it, but there's a little bit of debate, as I understand it, about the tense, as in past, present, future tense of the second half of verse 7, because it reads as past tense. But many think that this is David asking with such confident expectation that he states it as having already occurred. And then the psalm concludes with verse 8, which can be seen and read as a benediction, really. And I'm inclined to agree with others here and say that the salvation that's referred to in verse 8 doesn't just refer to, isn't limited to what we would call justification, being saved, but also to deliverance. God acting for him and for us in times of crisis, preserving us when a particular trouble befalls us. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Also sounds like the book of Jonah. It's helpful then, I think, to almost bring a paraphrase to the very last line of the psalm. Paraphrase it like this: "Upon your people be your blessing." So David wasn't just concerned for God's help personally. He wasn't just looking for deliverance for himself. He was also asking for God's blessing upon the people over whom he had been anointed as king. I think there's lessons for us to take there as well about looking out for others, particularly in our church family. So, that's perhaps quite a quick tour through 8 verses of Psalm 3, but by way of conclusion then, I'm going to, 3 points of conclusion, I'm going to quote Dale Ralph Davis one more time. Prayer is the way we slug our way through troubles. Prayer is the way we slug our way through troubles. And David shows us here. We have looked at David's example here in Psalm 3, but actually we can see also, can't we, the great King, King Jesus, and his same example which he left us. Many were coming for his life as well, weren't they, in the same way that David was experiencing. What was Jesus' response in the Garden of Gethsemane? He paused and prayed. So as we come to prayer now, this evening, we'll sing one more time and then we'll pray. As we come to prayer now, can I leave us all with the verse, the words of Hebrews 5, verse 7. Christ, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, was heard because of his godly fear. Hopefully that inspires us to come to God's throne of grace in a minute, to bring our prayers, to bring them boldly, to bring them confidently, and to bring them expectantly, knowing that we pray to the same God that David knew so confidently that he was.